More than in 1970, he relied on intimidation and power. He was wild when he needed to be, unafraid to brush back batters, and his fastball moved late, sinking as it approached the plate. Good thing, as 9 out of 10 pitches he threw were fastballs. In some games he never threw anything but the old number one, as he called it. When he did unleash the rare curve, it had nice movement. It was really more of a slurve, as much a slider as a curveball. But he invariably telegraphed the pitch by emitting a prodigious grunt. Whether due to the speed of his fastball or the infrequency of his curve, opponents had yet to catch on. By the start of the playoffs in early May, Scherzer had already thrown a one-hitter, a three-hitter, and a handful of shutouts. If he occasionally coughed on the mound, at times violently, few paid it much attention. 13. The first step. The boys talked about it all the time. They talked about it while hunting doves, while drinking covert beers down at Mile Corner, and on nights they snuck an extra friend into the drive-in movie theater in Decatur by stashing him in the trunk of Otta's Blue Impala. Theirs was a singular, unifying goal. Return to regionals and advance. Despite all the caveats, a thin roster, a young team, a weak conference, the boys were remarkably confident about their chances. Maybe, as Scherzer says, we were just too dumb to know better. For the third year in a row, the Iron Men had won the Meridian, and now boasted a 23-game conference winning streak that dated back 3 seasons. In truth, there was only one team in the area that worried them. As luck would have it, though, it was their first-round opponent in the district playoffs, Mount Zion. 2 of Macon's 3 losses had come at the hands of its rival, which seemed to grow stronger by the year. Buoyed by an influx of students from Decatur, Mount Zion's enrollments now topped 500, and its sports teams were so dominant that it no longer played Macon in football and basketball. Even so, the Iron Men were surprised to learn that Mount Zion coach Ed Neighbors intended to start arguably his team's third-best pitcher in the district opener. Only 23, Neighbors was a cocky, by-the-book coach who'd been named team MVP as a first baseman at Millikan University. He was young enough to think he knew it all, and talented and smart enough to back it up most of the time. He ran a tight program and didn't hesitate to lecture his players. The contrast between the two teams could scarcely have been starker. Come game day, as Neighbors led his team through drills down the right field line, yelling to be heard over the Macon music, he looked over at the Iron Men bench and saw an entire lineup that wouldn't cut it at his school, beginning with the coach, who lounged in a chair wearing sunglasses and a bemused expression. From the stands, Neighbors heard the Mount Zion fans. "Hey, you hippies," they yelled. "Turn off that damn music." It was only the beginning of the pleasantries that were exchanged that day. Separated by only 10 miles, Macon and Mount Zion overlapped in many respects, giving the rivalry an internecine feel. Had Jeff Glan lived one house to the east, for example, he would have attended Mount Zion. The players knew each other from summer ball or working the crops. The fans knew each other from church or the taverns, and relatives sometimes split based on school allegiance. Fistfights were known to break out in the stands, and always, the animosity was palpable. As Jeff Brueggemann, the sophomore ace for Mount Zion, put it, if the Macon game was the only game you won in a year, that was okay for a lot of people. Considering this, it was something of a risk for Neighbors to start lefty Gary Jones, despite the fact that sophomore Jeff Brueggemann had better numbers, and junior Rod Jones was equally, if not more, talented. Still, the move allowed Neighbors to save his best pitcher for the final and gave him the element of surprise, as both Brueggemann and Rod Jones had already faced, and it should be noted, beaten, Macon that season. It didn't take Neighbors long to regret his decision. By the 4th inning, Macon led 4-0. By the 7th, it was 8-2. Scherzer finished off the win in dominant fashion, then raised his hands to the sky. Most everyone was surprised. Their players are bigger and badder, Brian Snitker thought as he jogged in from right field. We had no business winning a game like this. Meanwhile, neighbors and the Mount Zion boys slumped off, dejected. They'd wanted to not only beat Macon, but destroy them. As Craig Brueggemann says, we thought we were better, plain and simple. That Macon crushed Blue Mound 10-0 the next day, behind a Hanbury one-hitter to take the district title and advance to the regionals for the second time in 2 years, didn't change neighbors' opinion of the Ironmen. Macon had just gotten lucky. Small-town teams like that never went that far. One of the umpires from the Blue Mound game, however, disagreed. After the Ironmen's win, as the team prepared to leave, he walked over and, after asking Sweet's permission, poked his head into the Macon bus. Boys, he said, I've umpired all year, and you all are the best team I've seen by far. I'm amazed I hadn't heard anything about you. The boys tried not to look shocked. Of all the teams at regionals, the ump continued, I haven't seen any that should beat you. I'll be following you guys. 4 days later, Macon proved the umpire right and advanced again, routing Decatur Eisenhower, a big city power and one-time state champion that had knocked off unbeaten MacArthur in the previous round. A year later, and against the odds, the Ironmen had returned to the regional finals. This time, there would be no disqualifications. For the people of Macon, just this was enough. For years, the town's football team had played second fiddle to conference rival Illiopolis. The basketball team had lodged 4 straight losing seasons. When the Ironmen track team challenged for the conference crown in 1970, it ended up having to share the honor with Stonington. For the baseball team to not only win 3 straight conference titles, but take down a big Decatur school at regionals, it was unimaginable. Of course, the boys saw it from a different perspective. Every game was an elimination game now. Every game meant the end of the season, and, for the seniors, the end of their high school careers. That the Ironmen were 1 win away from sectionals and 3 from state was never discussed. This was about doing what they'd pledged to do. Sweet was of a similar mind. The night before the final, he sat at the table in his trailer, talking with Jeannie. Slowly, over the months, she'd become part of the fabric of the team. She came to nearly every game, and spent weekend nights hanging out with the baseball parents at pig roasts and house parties. On occasion, she and Sweet hosted card games for the players at the trailer. Now, she understood the stakes. After all, it was only a year earlier that McClard had called the boys into his office and ended their season, and only 9 months since Sweet had been fired as baseball coach for being deemed a bad influence on the boys. Now, after all the anger and disappointment, followed by the resolve and preparation, the team, and Sweet, was getting a second chance, this time against Mount Pulaski. Win, and they'd advance further than any team in Macon history. It was more than that, though. Win, and the Ironmen would put Macon on the map. Win, and they'd prove McClard and all those anachronistic parents wrong. Win, and they'd create a legacy, the kind that can't be overvalued in a town as small and close-knit as Macon, where collective memory lives forever. For a game of this magnitude, any sane coach would certainly want his best pitcher on the mound. Instead, Lynn Sweet planned to send out John Hanbury. The men were easy to spot on Wednesday afternoon at Warrensburg Latham High, the site of the regional final. They came toting chair cushions and notebooks. They stood against the fence with fingers hooked through the wire. Older, with sun-wrinkled faces and leathery hands, they'd spent the bulk of their lives in search of hidden gems. They spoke the language of bat speed and sinking fastballs. Now they'd come to see the kid from Mount Pulaski. His name was Dennis Wirth, and he was a special talent. 3 years later, he would be drafted by the Yankees, becoming the pride of Mount Pulaski for generations to come. He would go on to play parts of 3 seasons in the Bronx. Decades later, his stepson, a tall, fast boy by the name of Jason, would be an all-star for the Philadelphia Phillies and win a World Series ring. For now, though, Dennis Wirth was merely the baddest high school player in Central Illinois. A senior, he'd started every game at catcher since he was a freshman, and opponents ran on him at their own peril. Teammates swear Wirth gunned down 3 out of every 4 would-be thieves, and, 10 times a season or so, picked a runner off first with a snap throw, an exceedingly difficult thing to do. At the plate, Wirth possessed the kind of natural power that can't be taught. As a skinny freshman playing in the regional finals against Lincoln High, he'd won the game by blasting a home run off a pitcher who was said to have entered the game with a 0.71 ERA. From that moment forward, Wirth seemed destined for success. It didn't take long for the scouts to materialize. On this afternoon, they received a surprise. The star catcher they came to see wasn't behind the plate, but on the mound. It was a switch made out of necessity. Mount Pulaski's top pitcher, John Jaggi, had pitched the first game in the regionals the day before, and the team's number 2 pitcher and cleanup hitter, Mark Dannenberger, broke his collarbone toward the end of the regular season. It fell to Wirth to take the mound. It wasn't a huge drop-off. Though he possessed no off-speed pitches, Wirth threw the ball as hard as any high schooler in Illinois. The same could not be said of the spindly boy who took the mound for the opposition, his shirt tails spilling out of his belt. As he peered in at Dean Otta, John Henneberry focused on one thing, starting strong. All season, his entire high school career, really, the first inning had been his weakness. His father could never figure it out. "Why do we go through it?" Jack Henneberry had asked his son one night a month earlier, while sitting at the dinner table after a game. "What do you mean?" John asked, even though he knew exactly what his father meant. Jack rubbed his forehead. "Why do you have to walk the first 2 guys every game?" "Well, you know, I didn't try to walk them." "Maybe you should take a longer warm-up," Jack said. He was always looking for ways to remedy his son's wildness. Certainly, there was a solution out there. "But I did that." Jack frowned. "Then don't do that. Try a shorter warm-up." And on it went, Jack suggesting physical solutions to what was likely a psychological issue. "Move to the other side of the rubber. Watch where you stride and how far. Dig a deeper hole for your cleat. Do something, anything, to get back on track." Now, just as Henneberry feared, his first pitch sailed wide. His second bounced in the dirt. Oh, crap. He walked 1 batter, gave up a single. "Don't get in a hole," Henneberry thought to himself. Crack. The ball soared into the alley for a triple. Hole dug. 2-0, Mount Pulaski. Outside the Mount Pulaski dugout, the boys took vigorous warm-up cuts, all of them now eager to get a crack at Henneberry. Though Wirth was the clear star, Mount Pulaski was by no means a one-man squad. The boys played baseball in the fall, 25 games, the spring, another 25, and the summer. The team was deep, well-coached, and took pride in its defense and pitching. Coming into the regional final, the players knew only that the Iron Men had an ace, a boy named Schartzer, and that they wouldn't have to face him. Now, up 2-0 in the second inning, and with Wirth mowing down the Iron Men, they felt even more confident. On the Macon bench, Sweet told the boys not to sweat the deficit. Wirth may be a hell of a pitcher, but if he was pitching, it meant he wasn't catching. All the Iron Men needed were base runners. In the 4th inning, they got one. Wirth lost control of a fastball and plunked Dale Otta. On the next pitch, Otta took off, swiping second. Moments later, he scored when Schartzer's grounder snuck through the infield. With that, the floodgates opened. Stu Arnold doubled home Schartzer. Dean Otta doubled home Arnold, and David Wells singled home another run. Just like that, the Ironmen led the regional final 4-2. Now it was up to Hennebery to hold the lead. With each at-bat by Wirth, Sweet held his breath. Yet time and again, Hennebery's curveball worked its magic. It had taken a while, but it was breaking again. Even Jaggy, who'd hit a first-inning triple, was stymied. Three times in a row, he struck out. Heading into the seventh inning, the score remained 4-2 in Macon's favor. Then, with two outs, the Ironmen took off running again. From the mound, Wirth could only watch in dismay as the Ironmen circled the bases. By the end of the inning, Macon had scored 5 runs, all with 2 outs, and stolen an astounding 9 bases on the day, including a daring swipe of home by Arnold. In the bottom of the inning, after a rough stretch, Hennebery closed it out with one final curveball that dropped like an elevator that's had its cable cut. And with that, it was over. In a game they were expected to lose, the Ironmen had somehow won in a rout, 9-4. Behind the backstop, the 200-odd Macon fans who'd made the trip leapt to their feet, arms upraised. Girlfriends shrieked, grown men bellowed. Sweet beamed like a lottery winner. The players slapped hands, smacked gloves, and exchanged hugs. Even McLeod looked pleased. Finally, they could say it. Regional champs! They were just boys. 15, 16, and 17-year-old boys who did boy things. Mark Miller could pass gas on command. Dale Otta was fascinated by model rockets. Steve Schartzer loved comic books. But somewhere in between the Mount Zion game and beating Mount Pulaski, they became more than boys. They became symbols of a town. Of many towns, really. Even over in Mount Zion, the players were rooting for Macon. Though, of course, they'd never admit it to the Ironmen. Strange as it may seem, the Macon boys were now heroes to many. Scott Taylor was 9 years old at the time and lived in Elwyn, one house down from Steve Schartzer. His father was good friends with Bob Schartzer and went to nearly every Macon High game, no matter the sport. Bob Taylor rooted for the basketball team, helped fix pregame dinners for the football team, and came to every baseball game. One year at the Macon High Athletic Banquet, the school awarded Taylor a plaque as Macon's number one fan. It stayed on his mantle for decades. His son was right there with him. To Scott, there was nobody on the planet more amazing than Steven Schartzer. Many an afternoon, Scott sat on his porch waiting for Steve to launch a wiffle ball into his yard, just so he could return it and perhaps be invited to play. It wasn't just Steve, though. Scott looked up to all the boys on the team. He fetched foul balls at games. He sat on the end of the bench, mute, just so he could overhear the players joking and laughing. Every once in a while, he says, I'd even get to play catch with them. During away games, Scott's father pulled him out of school and brought him along. He saw the boys' pictures in the paper. He read the articles. There was no pro team within easy driving distance of Elwyn, just the Class A Commodores in Decatur. In a world of 3 TV channels and 1 grocery store, being the star athlete at Macon High was about as big as it got. To Scott, the Ironmen were the closest thing in his life to celebrities. Some of the players were oblivious to the power they now wielded. They were teenagers, after all. But not Schartzer. Blessed with talent and confidence, he was also cursed with self-awareness. He understood the stakes. This wasn't just about teammates and parents anymore. This was about all those folks at the Country Manor. It was about legacy and civic pride. It was about the Scott Taylors. He didn't intend to let any of them down. 14. We've only just begun. Would they even show? All day the girls wondered. You never knew with those boys, after all. They might decide to go off fishing or drinking beers. An impromptu game of over the line might take precedence. Come 7 p.m. on Saturday, May 22nd, however, they were all there. There was Mark